Hi there, listener, and welcome to this special episode of the Ski Podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today by John Yates Smith. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, you will almost certainly have heard of Val d'Isère, but it's possible you may not have heard of the man known by many as Mr. Val d'Isère. John has spent almost 50 winters in the resort, starting from his days as a rep in the early days of the British ski industry. He ran Blade & Lyons operation there for a decade before starting his own chalet company, YSE, which has now been offering ski holidays in Val d'Isère for over 30 years. Hi, John. Welcome to the Ski Podcast. How are you today?
I'm very well, Ian. Thank you. Yes, no, I've done 49 winters now, and I didn't start as a rep. I started as a dishwasher.
I promoted you there accidentally.
You did.
And where are you today?
I'm in Val d'Isère, in one of our chalets, La Maison du Rocher. I live here in great luxury in the summer, and then I move to a shoebox where I live in the winter.
Excellent. So some aspects of seasonal life are still the same. Now, we are going to come on to your career and your different experiences in Val d'Isère in due course, but a question I always like to start off asking my guests with is, when did you last ski or snowboard?
Well, snowboard never, and I never will. Evil bloody sport, should be banned. But skiing, I skied quite a few times, I don't know, maybe 8 times, 10 times in April 24th.
Let's focus on Val d'Isère as a ski resort in the winter. I referred to the fact that you ran Blade & Lyons operation in Val d'Isère for a decade. That actually is the reason we're here today, because I wrote an article about Blade & Lyons a couple of years ago now, I think it was, for the Ski Club of Great Britain magazine. And listener, I'll put a link into the show notes about that. But when we were chatting, you know, I realized that we really, you know, should try and find some time to go through things in a little bit more detail. And the reason you're in Val d'Isère now, and I can see you're wearing your branded top today for YSE, which is keeping on brand there.
I have to wear it because we've got about 300 of these polo shirts that come back at the end of the winter and get a good wash and iron. And it means I can change my T-shirt every day, twice a day through the summer and never have to wash anything. So I'm always wearing a branded polo.
Excellent. Well, YSE, I mentioned it before, you set up your own company. That's been running for over 30 years now. It's a Val d'Isère specialist. I think it was founded in 1991. I mean, in that amount of time, you've been through multiple recessions, COVID, and Brexit. But as I mentioned, you've been in business for over 30 years. You know, a lot of companies have fallen along the wayside. What do you put that longevity down to?
It's a matriarchy. YSE is run by hyper-efficient ladies. Fiona Easdale, the E of YSE in London, and Annabelle Clifton here in Val d'Isère. And they just... they're just so efficient. I'm YSE's token male, and I'm the young Mr. Grace of YSE going around saying, you've all done very well. Hyper-efficient ladies is why YSE has never tried to expand too much, stayed pretty much the same size that we were at the beginning, and will continue for another 50 years.
It's great to hear, and very modest of you as well. I mean, you're still a chalet company. You specialize in catered chalet holidays. What about the challenges of Brexit? You know, have you found the company come through that?
Brexit has been a nightmare. I would have voted for Brexit. I wasn't in Britain at the time, so I didn't make that mistake. I would have done. I'm not a great fan of the European Union. I think it's destroying Europe, ruining Europe. But Brexit has been a nightmare for us. And to give an idea of the difference it's made, we used to be able to employ our staff on British contracts, and I think their national insurance contributions were about £2 per employee per month. We're now on £500. I paid something over £100,000 to the French Social Security last winter, and I'm the only person who's been here long enough to be allowed to use any of it. The seasonal staff are not allowed to.
So, evidently, the costs of employing staff have gone up. And I'm aware, you know, it's possible to get visas. There's a process that you need to go through. But presumably, that's put the cost of holidays up significantly. And have you seen that impact on demand at all?
No. It has put up the price, not as much as you might imagine, because quite a few of our competitors have fallen by the wayside. So we are fuller than ever. And if you're full, you don't need to raise your prices hugely. It's being full that enables you to carry on surviving. If you've got 20% of your beds empty, you're going to be in trouble. But if you're very full, as we tend to be, you can survive without whacking your prices up too much. But it's definitely not cheap.
And remind me how many chalets you have in Val d'Isère.
We have 18 chalets and catered apartments and one little hotel that we run as a chalet.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. And I'm always pleased to hear about stories of companies who've seen off Brexit. And also, I kind of think what you're talking about there is, you know, indicative of the fact that there are fewer chalet companies around now. There are a few chalets on offer, yet there's a big part of that British market who want to take chalet holidays still. And so for companies like yourself, and I might mention another like Le Ski, for example, who've been around for a similar amount of time, but you've built up a loyal clientele, because you manage to offer a good product, people who want chalet holidays will come back and they're prepared to pay a little bit more if necessary to get that.
I think so. At least 75% of our guests have been with us before. And that's really nice for us. It's lovely to have the same people coming back. They know what we're about. And we have many guests who come twice or three times a year and have been doing so for 20 years. Yeah, that's good business for us. And it presumably means that we're doing something right.
Well, you certainly have, you know, as you've indicated, with almost 50 years of experience of working in Val d'Isère, the knowledge of the resort. I wondered, when you first became a skier yourself?
I got a job. I was doing languages at university, and I got a job as an assistant in a Swiss grammar school. And while I was there, my brother, who'd been in the army and had become a good skier in the British Army in Germany, and then again, he was posted to the Canadian Army for 2 years, and he became a good skier, resigned his commission because after 2 years in Quebec, his next posting was to be family's officer at Tidworth. And he didn't fancy that. So he resigned and became a rep for John Morgan Travel in Val d'Isère on £12 a week. And he rang me. I was working as a civil servant for the government of the Free State of Bavaria in a castle near Nuremberg. And he rang me and said, would you like to spend the rest of the winter in Val d'Isère? I think this was probably late December. And 75. And I said, wow, yes, good. Doing what? And he said, washing dishes. I said, well, yeah, I suppose I can wash dishes. What's the pay? He said, £5 a week. I said, I only earn £5 a week. He said, well, you don't actually earn it. You pay it because you've got to pay for your food. I said, well, that doesn't sound a great deal. What are the upsides? He said, the best skiing in the world and a lot of very pretty chalet girls. I said, count me in. Just after New Year 1976, I was in Val d'Isère and have been here ever since.
Wow, that's fantastic. In fact, you know, in discussions about what the best job is in a ski resort, and you know, I haven't quite done as many seasons as you, but I did manage to do six winter seasons. I think being a KP, a washer-upper, is kind of regarded as the best, because although the pay isn't particularly good, you don't have any responsibility, you actually don't have any guest contact either, and as soon as you've done your job, you can get on the mountain and spend the maximum amount of time skiing.
Totally. We have various people we employ as dishwashers and drivers and delivering things and carrying things around, and they just have the time of their lives. I think I bump into people who worked with us 20, 30, 40 years ago, and they still say that was the best 5 months of my life.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, I ended up setting up a business called Natives, which is all about that community for seasoned workers, because, to kind of praise here, I found it really frustrating coming back after the end of the season. And, you know, your friends would say, oh, what was it like? And you just can't compress the experience, that really intense experience of 5 months into, you know, a sentence or anything. It's only people who've done it who can understand it. And it really is an amazing experience. And you worked, you know, for John Morgan to start off with, sadly no longer with us. Also, you did some seasons for Ski Val as well. I think they went out of business around Brexit time. This is very early on for British skiing. I mean, not many people had really even discovered chalet holidays at that point. What was the clientele like at that time?
The clientele was surprisingly similar to now. Very nice people. I mean, I meet, 3,000 or 4,000 people every winter. And the new lot come in, and they come in at Geneva Airport looking a bit lost and a bit gormless. Or they're very demanding. Or I think, oh, God, come back last week's lot. This week's lot are going to be a nightmare. And then they're always lovely. Always. I mean, I meet about one annoying guest a winter out of 4,000. The other 3,999 are really, really just nice, undemanding, sympathetic people. And I'm amazed every winter that I think at the end of the winter, like, who are we going to ban for next year? And I can't think of anybody.
Right. Okay. And, you know, now I think a lot of people would think of Val d'Isère, you know, maybe along with Mirabel as being one of the most, British influenced resorts. Were there a high proportion of Brits in Val d'Isère back then in the late 70s, early 80s?
No, far fewer than now. I mean, it was probably, I don't know, maybe 5% of the people who skied in Val d'Isère. And now we're nearer 50%, I guess. Actually, we've gone down from that a bit since Brexit. There are, it's a smaller percentage now, but it does feel British, but in quite a nice way. There are not that many British running restaurants and bars and businesses and things. The resort doesn't feel very British. And the British who come here tend to be people who want to come to France. They're not aiming to ski somewhere that feels horribly British. I don't think Val d'Isère, in spite of the large number of Brits who come here, I don't think it feels like a British resort.
No, I mean, I don't feel that either. And I love Val d'Isère. I've been for a few seasons. I'm hoping to go again this winter to have a look at the new lift that's opening up. However, you mentioned British businesses in Val d'Isère, and you mentioned your brother, you know, was working for John Morgan and gave you the call to get you to come out there in the first place. We should probably, if you don't mind segueing onto him a little bit, mention his name, because your brother is Dick, I'm guessing, because he set up Dick's Tea Bar. Is that right?
Yes, he did. I initially found it. I was on a romantic interlude to Val d'Isère, and the road got blocked by a landslide or something. So I was here kicking my heels for a couple of days. I thought I better do something. My brother was working for John Morgan in London at that point and not really enjoying it. And I wandered around to see whether there was somewhere he could open a little bar or something. And I found this games room full of one-armed bandits. And I spoke to the owner and said, could we turn that into a tea room? And he said, yes. And I spoke to the mayor and said, could we open a tea room? And he said, yes. And I spoke to my brother and said, would you like to open a tea room? And he said, yes. And out he came. And I thought he was just going to sort of put in a couple of chairs and a coffee machine. He actually went really to town and made it, because he'd always had sort of traveling discotheques when he was in the army. He was always traveling around with a sort of portable discotheque, and he set it up there and lighting and screens and all sorts of things. In fact, he had just put up his new lights, which were actually yogurt containers painted black, but they looked like proper lights. He just put the last one up on the ceiling, walked out of the bar for a couple of minutes, probably to have a fag, and there was an earthquake. And all over Val d'Isère, people ran out of their buildings, except my brother, who ran into his to hold up his newly fitted yogurt pots so that they didn't fall off the ceiling. So that was the start of Dick's Tea Bar. And every year he made it bigger and better. He doesn't do things by halves. And yes, it became the biggest purveyor of beer, I think, in France, and hugely, hugely well known. Everybody knew about Dick's Tea Bar in those days.
Maybe they still do, although I've got to ask, you asked the mayor about starting up a tea bar. Is that just like a well-known metaphor in France, or did you actually say to them, yeah, we'll be doing tea and cake and something like that, not like filling lots of people with vodka and beer?
Well, I thought that's what it would be. That was my idea, that it would be a sort of afternoon place where people would just meet and have a chat and a coffee or a tea. I didn't realize it would become quite such a big thing. And now it's gone to being really a pure nightclub. When Dick was running it, it was an après-ski bar, and we reps used to meet there and have our office hours there. And it was alive all the time. There were films on, and people gave lectures, and all sorts of things used to happen there. Now I think it's more, I don't go in. I don't think I'd be allowed in. I think they'd say, no, sorry, you're too old, stay outside. But it's now just a nightclub as far as I know.
I have had many great experiences there. And when I was doing Natives, we did a tour of events in different ski resorts. And we'd always have one in Val d'Isère in an early December week when all the universities came and, you know, put on some promotional parties there. And the queues outside were just amazing. Let's move on a little bit then. I mentioned Bladen Lines, and you worked a few seasons in 1982. You moved to Bladen Lines, and like I said, I'm going to put a link to in my show notes to that article, which is called "The Rise and Fall of Bladen Lines." It was founded in 1978, and they were growing really fast. You told me in our last interview. What was it, do you think, that made Bladen Lines, or gave Bladen Lines, that extra edge that made them grow so fast?
I think it was Mark Lines, who was an incredibly dynamic man. And just, he'd been on lots of chalet holidays with different companies, Super Travel and John Morgan and so on, and was just appalled by how amateurish they were. And he came in intending to do it better. And he and Simon Bladen, between them, knew most of the wealthy people in Britain, as far as I can see. And they did set up this company that was, I mean, at the start, they were serving grouse in the chalets and so on. By the time they finished, they had copied the other companies and gone pretty much down market. But at the start, they were very ambitious and very efficient. So they tripled in size. They were, I don't know how many beds they had in the first season, 20 or something. The second season, 120. The third season, 360. The fourth season, over 7. It was something like that. They tripled, then doubled in size. I joined them, I think, when they were 27 times bigger than they had been. And I brought in some extra beds and brought them down market quite seriously.
Well, that's probably a matter for debate, but you certainly, other people have said to me as well that Mark Lines was a kind of quite, you know, an inspirational type of guy, very good at motivating people and very good with ideas. I think one of the ideas he brought in was that branding around the parrots, because the Bladen Lines staff already had these multicoloured uniforms, and some of the other companies disparagingly referred to them as parrots. And he just kind of completely reversed that, took it on board and actually incorporated it into the logo.
Yeah, that was typical Mark Lines. He was a brilliant communicator, had wonderful ideas. I absolutely hated my parrot jacket and refused to wear it until they gave me a pay rise, when I begrudgingly wore it. But I think Mark Lines might have been colorblind. I don't think you could have made people wear clothes like that unless you were.
Well, they certainly stood out on the slope. So you're working with chalets back in the 70s and in the 80s, and working for Bladen Lines, and you already referred to how, you know, Brexit has changed the recruitment side of things. But what about recruitment back then and the type of staff who came on board? How is it different then?
It's become more democratized. In those days, everybody working in a chalet company had been to Benenden or Rodine or something, Cheltenham. It's now become less like that. But I think there's still, even people who like me, didn't go to a fancy ladies' school, still aim high. I think there's still a mentality in the ski industry, certainly the ski industry in Val d'Isère. I don't really know what it's like anywhere else, but in Val d'Isère, there's very much a feeling that standards need to be maintained and people want to do a good job. I think actually I'm amazed by modern youth. I always say that modern youth can't do anything unless it involves using two thumbs and a telephone. But in fact, with every passing year, at the end of the season, I think, God, this year's staff were the best ever. Just a tiny bit better than last year's, who had been a tiny bit better than the year before's. And I think that young people, I don't know whether it's something to do with the lead in petrol, but there's something that is making young people better, nicer, more dependable, just better people. My intake, 1975-6, my first winter, none of us would even get an interview with Fiona Easdale at YSE now. We were a bunch of completely useless, stuck-up idiots compared with the kids we get nowadays who are really, really good people, to my astonishment.
That is really good to hear. It's lovely to hear some positive feedback about, you know, Gen Z. We don't always get that. And I think listeners, probably to put it in context, you're talking about when you were starting doing your seasons. Some listeners may not even know that this is like a pre-digital world. There were no mobile phones, no internet. You know, even during the course of your career, you know, faxes came in and they made a huge difference when they first started.
Totally. We used to communicate by telex. Telex, for anybody under about 60, was a thing you typed into a machine and a strip of paper came out with little holes in it. You put that into another machine, which sent a lot of beeps and dots down the telephone line, and a strip of paper came out at the other end. You put that into a machine, and lo and behold, out came the message. And I mean, when faxes came in, faxes were wonderful. Gosh, you could write something and send it, and people could read it at the other end. So, yeah, that, looking back now, we didn't have mobile phones. We would leave. We used to have Blade Lines. We used to have four or five coaches leaving Val d'Isère, and they would leave at quarter hour intervals so that they didn't all hit the airport at the same time. And we would arrive. I would always go on the first. We'd arrive in Annecy. There were traffic jams. There were problems, that sort of thing. I'd ring the airport, check the plane was on time. And then I would stick up a note in a phone box next to the public loos in Annecy, saying I left at 11, bus 2 should leave at 11:15, whatever. And then the last rep took down that sellotaped notice and threw it in the bin. And so that's how we communicated, but it was pretty amateurish. And when mobile phones came in, I'm a bit of a Luddite. I didn't like the idea of mobile phones. I like phones, you put fourpence in them, press button A. And so I refused to have one, but I finally was persuaded I ought to have a mobile phone. And the first week I went on a bus with a mobile phone, Annabelle in Val d'Isère rang me and said, did I know that our plane was going to be 4 hours late? No, I didn't. Did I know that Zermatt was cut off and that their customers were going to be 4 or 5 hours late? No, I didn't. Did I know that their plane was about to land on time? No, I didn't. Well, add two and two together. And so I did. I rang Geneva Airport and said, can we have that plane? They said, oh, better ask Britannia. Britannia were wonderful in those days. I don't know what they're like now, but in those days, Britannia, who became Thomson Fly and then later TUI, they were wonderful. I rang them and said, look, there's a plane on the ground. It's supposed to be going to carrying this number of people, but could it carry that number and go now? And they said, yep. So we turned up at the airport, a plane was waiting, guests got on it. And then when the Zermatt people arrived, a plane was waiting, they got on it. And so that convinced me that mobile phones perhaps weren't such a bad idea.
Yeah. And you're, I mean, obviously they would have, you know, they could have been very useful at certain times, because your role at Blade Lights was coordinating transfers all the way across all of the Haute Tarentaise resorts and running the airports.
Yes, I had to try to work out what time the buses should leave each resort. On busy weekends, it sometimes took 10 hours to get from Geneva to Val d'Isère or Courchevel or Mirabel, Lizard, La Plagne. And just weight of traffic, the number of people, particularly at the end of the 80s, early 90s, when the roads were all being rebuilt for the 92 Olympics. And it could take hours and hours and hours. And coming up the hill, people would get stuck in these terrible jams. They'd expect to be in Val d'Isère at lunchtime. They would get there at bedtime. And so I would take the statistics. I would know how long the delays had been, how many people were in each resort, whether they'd come via Geneva because they were coming from the east of France, or via Lyon because they were coming from the Paris region. And I would work out at what time the buses needed to leave. And I did it very scientifically. The only problem is, if you've been stuck in a horrible traffic jam coming to your resort, you leave at a different time going back. So you either leave in the middle of the night or you stay on for the day and leave the following evening. So if there were bad jams coming up the hill, they never were going down. And then there'd be a weekend when there were no jams coming up the hill. Everybody would leave after breakfast and there'd be a jam going down the hill. So I systematically got it wrong week after week, but not for want of trying.
I mean, to put it in context again for listeners who might not be aware, you know, back then there was no Geneva to Albertville motorway. I think all the traffic, you know, routed along that road that goes alongside Lake Annecy, and the traffic jams going through there and then to Eugene and then to Albertville and then to Moutier, they could be biblical with everyone backed up all the way along, you know, almost all the way back to Annecy.
I think the longest journey I ever did without there being avalanches, landslides, flooding, whatever, was 13 hours from Geneva to Val d'Isère. You can do it in 2 hours and about 40 minutes. 13 was the worst, but we had days when we spent nights at Geneva. We spent nights in Moutier. The jams, particularly when they were rebuilding the roads, were absolutely appalling. And very, very difficult to predict. I remember counting the cars that were going through a particular roadworks place, and there were sort of five going through a minute or something, and I knew that there were 40,000 cars trying to come down that road, and the sums were frightening. It was pretty epic, to be honest.
And complicated in terms of the logistical side of things as well, by the fact that people were arriving by train in the morning, and in those days people were still taking overnight coaches as a form of transport. I know that still exists to a certain extent, but you know, you had people arriving first thing.
At Bladen Lines, we had people arriving on up to 20 different flights through the day. We had people arriving by train in the morning, by overland coach for breakfast, by car at any particular point. And so people arrived any time from about 6 a.m. until midnight on a Saturday, and normally wanted to go into their chalet, not realizing their predecessors hadn't yet left. And that was a nightmare. I don't know how I survived those years. Thank God we don't do anything complicated like that now.
I used to rep for Crystal off the snow train coming into Moutier. And another aspect of that is that in those days there was no tunnel, I'm thinking. So people must have taken the ferry over from to Calais, and they would stock up on duty-free beer, and they'd arrive in the morning with these massive great slabs of beer that they tucked into most of it during the night. So they'd be off their heads, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, added to the complications of having nowhere to put them once they got into resort.
I think Fiona, who was managing director of Bladen Lines for several years, was dealing with 200 complaints letters per week on average. And most of the complaints were about the travel arrangements. We at YSE, I think we had a complaints letter about 4 years ago, but we just keep things simple. It's not that we're particularly clever. We just keep things simple. I'm too old to have to handle angry guests. And so we do everything possible to prevent them.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. What about, I don't think this is apocryphal, but am I right in thinking, so when I went to the airport, you know, I'd come back and I'd do my coach speech and tell my guests about all of the different bits and pieces, from the lift passes to the ski hire, après-ski, all of this type of stuff. But am I right in thinking that you used to pre-record a coach speech that you would give to all of your reps, that they'd slot into the tape player in the coach on the way back from the airport?
Well, at the very start, when I worked for Ski Val, we had 13 beds and we had 13 guests, and we'd go and pick them up in a couple of VW minibuses, and I would chat away on my bus to the people. And then we graduated to a proper coach, and so I would speak into the microphone. And then we graduated to two coaches, and I would hop between the two and give the same speech in each bus. And once I got off the first bus to jump on the second, And I saw him take a shortcut around Moutier and disappear down another road. And I realized I was in trouble. I was standing beside the road. The second bus wasn't going to come. So my bus was just leaving. And I sprinted down the road after it, grabbed hold of the ski rack, which was an open ski rack, thank God, and jumped into it, thinking, oh, I'll just bang on the window and get them to stop. Well, you can't bang on the window. Those ski racks are enclosed. And so I'm there at about -5, wearing a T-shirt and breathing neat diesel. And I thought, well, where will the coach next stop between Moutier and Val d'Isère? It probably won't. I'm going to be here in the ski rack for an hour and a half. And thank God, about 10 minutes later, about sort of 5 or 6 miles down the road, the coach did stop for a roundabout or something. And I leapt out of the ski rack and ran around and banged on the driver's door. And he opened the door and said, my God, you ran fast. So I had run 5 miles in 10 minutes. That would have broken a few records. But anyway, so after that, I thought, God, I can't take that risk again. I'm going to record it. And I only did it for that one week or for that one season. I thought, I'll just record a cassette. But in fact, it worked quite well. I never dared actually play the cassette on my own bus. I still do the same. I still make it's a CD now or a USB stick. I still do that. And whatever bus I'm not on gets the same boring speech. But at least that way we know that guests have been given the latest up-to-date information. And any bits I've forgotten because I went to sleep during the recording or something, we know that all of the buses have not been given that bit of information, so we can catch it up. So it's just a way of sort of standardizing things and gives me a purpose in life.
And you mentioned before that, you know, so many of your clients are repeat clients anyway. I would therefore imagine it's quite reassuring for them to hear your voice as they hop on the coach. And, you know, this is with YSE now. I mean, we said you did almost 10 years with Blame Lines, and in 1991 you started YSE, and you mentioned Fiona Easdale, the matriarch that you work with, because you were both working for Blame Lines at the time, immediately prior to starting YSE.
Bladen Lines was absolutely flying. It was the top ski holiday company in Britain. I think it had more guests than any other British ski holiday company, including Thompson's. It was enormous, and it was flying, and it was doing very, very well. Now, Simon Bladen and Mark Lines had both sold out to a very wealthy young man who'd inherited a lot of money from his father. And Fiona was the managing director and running it beautifully. But the young man who bought the company didn't appreciate having his new toy run by this woman who was 28 years old, hyper efficient, obviously aware that he didn't really know much about the business. And I think possibly she didn't make it sufficiently unobvious that he didn't know what he was doing. And he called her into his office one night. She thought for a pay rise, because what Bladen Lines was doing so well. And he gave her the sack. He couldn't bear having this girl upstage him. So she rang me. I was working in Corsica at the time. She rang me and she said, that bloody idiot has sacked me. I thought, oh my God, if he's going to sack the best person in the company, there's not much hope for the rest of us. So she said, so we set up our own little company and just do Val d'Isère. And I said, well, that sounds a great idea. And that's where it came from.
When you started up, you started with some of the properties that have been with Bladen Lines just immediately. How did you manage to kind of nab them off them?
Well, I was astonished. I said to our owners, I am leaving Bladen Lines, who you've been very happy with. I'm setting up my own little company. And they said, well, we'll come with you. The French are a surprising race. They're very loyal to people and not particularly to brands. So they didn't give a stuff whether it was Bladen Lines or YSE. They knew me. They said, we know you. You've never let us down too badly so far. We'll come with you. And apart from one guy, I think all of the other chalet owners said, well, we'll come with you. It's very surprising. I've been here off and on, and most recently, I now live in Val d'Isère since Brexit. I live here because of the 90-day business. You can only stay 90 days in 180 as a Brit. So I now have residence here. The French are a surprising race. They will, if they don't know you, treat you really badly. Go into a post office or something. If they don't know you, they'll glare at you and probably carry on chatting behind the counter. But if they know you and if they think you're not totally evil, they're incredibly nice people. It's taken me a long while to really get to understand the French, I think, but I adore the French. And fortunately, they came with us when we set up YSE.
And I think, you know, you possibly alluded to it there. I mean, Blade and Lines were already in decline, I think, by then. You know, there'd been new entrants into the market. And this is all different elements that I examined in the article I wrote. There's a clue in the title, A Rise and Fall of Blade and Lines. You know, Crystal came in. They were very aggressive with contracting. And then Ingham's bought the brand, you know, for next to nothing. And very shortly after that, Blade and Lines, you know, disappeared. And while I appreciate they were, you know, a competitor of yours, was it sad to see Blade and Lines go?
No, I was absolutely delighted. I'm always very happy to see any of our competitors go under. Every time I hear that another company's closed down on the internet, everyone says, oh, isn't it a shame? Such and such a company's gone. I think, bloody good thing. One less competitor nicking our customers and forcing us to offer deals and all the rest of it. So, no, I was delighted to see them go, particularly since I didn't feel that Fiona had been treated well. I couldn't complain myself, but Fiona had been treated pretty badly. So I wasn't sorry to see Blade and Lines disappear.
Yeah, it's very entertaining to hear that. Okay, now you referred to Corsica earlier. You said you're in Corsica when Fiona rang you, you know, with the idea of setting up a YSE. And, you know, most people probably don't realise Blade and Lines had a summer operation in Corsica. I think you set that up. How did that come about?
I was working as a water ski and windsurf instructor in Corsica, which sounds very grand, but in fact, the school I worked for was typically Corsican. I learned to windsurf on the Monday and became an instructor on the Tuesday. My water skiing instruction was fairly similar. I had a little teach yourself water skiing book on my knees under the steering wheel and would have a quick look and then tell people what they were doing wrong. Fortunately, you don't have to demonstrate water skiing. It's not like skiing where you have to be able to ski to teach it. Water skiing, you just have to be able to look at a picture of someone doing it properly and tell your poor pupil what he's doing wrong. Anyway, so I was working on this beach and there was a rather nice 3-star hotel behind the beach. And one day the owner said to me, do you know anybody who would like to rent our hotel? But I said, I think I possibly do. And I spoke to Blade and Nines. They said, yes, we'd be interested. And I think then a year later, we set up a company together, Yates Smith Blade and Nines. It was actually called it. It never made any money, and just slowly disappeared. But we ran this hotel on a beach in Corsica for many years. And it was such fun. It was a slightly tumbled down hotel. They'd built it using sand from the beach. Apparently you can't make cement or concrete with sand that's got salt in it. It just slowly disintegrates. So the hotel was slowly falling down and has since been had fallen down completely and now been replaced by a massive block of flats. But we ran it like a ski chalet and lots of glue vine and everybody we just all ate together and Corsica's a wonderful, wonderful place. Not nearly visited enough by the Brits. I go back to Corsica every summer. I absolutely love it. And it is a great, great place. And so we had a lot of fun. I ran that hotel for 8 years, ran it into the ground, but we had a lot of fun.
Just to clarify, so that was the Velinco. I'm sure that will bring back a lot of her memories. And I would second what you say about Corsica. I've been there 3 times before. Absolutely love it in Corsica. Something that I haven't experienced though, but I think that you did. You know, Corsicans are very proud of their nation, you might call it. And in fact, the Moor's Head sticker, which a lot of people have seen on the back of cars, is often put on there to give yourself a bit of credibility. But I think I'm right to say that you had some attention from the Corsican mafia at some point.
Yeah, the Corsicans describe it as a mafia. It's not the real Italian mafia, who I don't think have, or certainly didn't in those days, have a foothold in in Corsica, because the mafia are criminals who exploit honest people and live off honest people. There are no honest people in Corsica. Everybody is a criminal. And so the mafia couldn't really get a toehold there. Everybody belongs to one clan or another, and they're all, I mean, they say the major industry in Corsica is agriculture. Well, I don't think it is. I think it's fiddling the French state. That's the first way they make money. Second way is organized crime. Third way is probably tourism, and fourth way maybe agriculture. But it's a wonderful country. And because they're so stroppy, no one can come in from outside. So it's got a coastline that's very much like the south of France. But no one can build big buildings along it because the Corsicans won't let people from outside do it. Or they'll let you build something and then they'll blow it up. Once it's built and all the local builders have been paid, they'll then blow it up. So that deters outsiders from coming in and spoiling the coastline. So Corsica is the most unspoiled. I go there every summer. I take my kids. I started taking them when they were about four. Now they're in their 20s and they've got better people to go on holiday with than their dad. But I think I'm still going to go there this summer just to sit on a beach and eat cheese donuts. I just can't wait to get back there.
I mentioned you had some attention from them. Was your, like, your car set on fire or something like that? Or maybe even you heard that you were on a kind of, you know, hit list?
Yes, they set fire to my car at one point. I got involved. They were planning to build a road. The mayor of the town was a road builder. And so he built roads all over the place. He wanted to build a road along our beach. And I suggested this wouldn't be a very good idea. And I wrote a few letters to people saying this is not a good idea. And of course, the people who are going to make a lot of money because they had land adjacent to the beach were not happy to have this roast beef foreigner coming in and telling them what to do. So they set fire to my car. They then set fire to the hotel. It didn't. All the guests lined up with tooth mugs full of water, and we put the fire out. It wasn't a huge fire. But I slept for 8 years with a loaded shotgun by my bed, because on the first day we opened the hotel, the gendarmes came and they said, "Bonjour, monsieur, gendarmerie nationale. Could you haven't put your prices up outside your bar, which is obligatory." And I said, "Well, we don't have a bar, so we don't have any prices." "Ah," they said, "well, you don't need them." He said, "By the way, monsieur, what gun have you got?" I said, "What gun?" "Yes, what gun have you got, monsieur?" I said, "I haven't got a gun." They said, "No, come on, monsieur, you can tell us. We do need to know how everybody in the town protects themselves." I said, "I haven't got a gun." And they looked at each other and laughed. And they said, "He hasn't got a gun. He's a nutcase." They said, "Monsieur Gendarmerie Nationale, our advice is go to Monsieur Burezi's gun shop now on the high street and buy yourself a gun." So I bought myself a 12-bore shotgun. And the advice from the shopkeeper was a thing called chevrotine, which is ball bearings. You have a very large cartridge with an extra charge of cordite and ball bearings in it. And I said, "Well, I'll have some of that then." He said to me, "What do you hunt?" I said, "Oh, a bit of this, bit of that." He said, "Blackbirds and thrushes?" I said, "No, of course I don't shoot blackbirds and thrushes." He said, "Ah, rabbits and hares." I said, "I'm British. I don't shoot rabbits and hares. Bigger." He said, "Ah," he said, "the wild boar." I said, "No, I've never seen a wild boar. And if I ever do, I'm not going to take a pot shot at it. I'm going to be up the nearest tree." I said, "Bigger." He said, "There is only one bigger game in Corsica than the wild boar." He said, "Your neighbor." I said, "Well, not specifically Madame Pontalacci herself, but that size of target." And he said, "What you need is chevrotine." So he said, "But do you want the 9 or the 12? I said, "What's the difference?" He said, "The 9 has 9 huge ball bearings. The 12 slightly smaller ball bearings." I said, "What do you recommend?" He said, "Well, if you shoot someone with the 9, it looks as though you did it deliberately. Whereas if you shoot them with the 12, it was a hunting accident." So I left the shop with a packet of 12 ball bearing things. And I slept with that gun by my bed for 8 years, but I'm glad to say I never actually had to fire it. I pointed it at people a few times.
I'm delighted to hear that you never used it. And funny you should mention wild boar. surely they're all over Corsica, because I remember when we did a hike, the Mare Mare Sud, and kind of every, you know, guest house along the way, the menu was wild boar and mashed potatoes.
Yes. There are a lot of wild boar. You need to go up into the Maquis to hunt them, I think. They do come down into the villages and destroy people's gardens in the middle of the night. I did eat wild boar in a restaurant in the north of Corsica, and the guy said, "Do you know how I hunt these?" I said, "No." He whipped a Colt 45 out of his pocket and fired a shot out of the window. The gun was about 6 inches behind my head when he fired it, deafened me for about half an hour. There are more guns in Corsica than people, and they love firing them. If they go out hunting and they don't see anything to shoot, they shoot the name board of their village when they come back, which is why all of the village name boards are full of holes, quite large holes, because when they shoot a wild boar, they do it with a single ball bearing the size of a gobstopper. And so if they don't find a wild boar, they shoot the village sign. They've got these massive holes in them.
That's fascinating. I will look out for that when I'm in Corsica. I think I've seen that before. You must feel much safer these days living in Val d'Isère. And, you know, that is so interesting. Our whole conversation there, you know, moving through from the 70s and the ski business back in the 70s into the 80s, that Bladen Lines period, and everything with YSE, and to have been in business, as I said, for over 30 years. And I'm guessing that with 49 seasons or 48 seasons under your belt, there can't be many people who've done more seasons than you who are British anywhere.
I think I'm the oldest rep in the Alps, which is not necessarily something to be proud of, but yes, I've done a lot of seasons. But when I look back, I actually can't remember much about any of them. They all sort of blur into one. People love their ski holidays. People come out in a good mood. If the journey's not been a nightmare, they arrive in a good mood. People are surprisingly easy if something goes wrong. Also, being old is an advantage. If the boiler's blown up or something, and which does happen, boilers only blow up when they're being used, and they're only used in the winter. So every few years we have a boiler we've very quickly got to replace. Our staff get it in the neck from the guests. What are we supposed to do? The water's cold. It's above freezing cold. We've come back. I go in with a crate of champagne and I say, "Look, I'm really sorry. We're getting this repaired tonight. But for the moment, have some champagne on me." And they say, "Oh, God, no, sit down, old fellow. Come and have a cup of tea with us. Don't get excited. You'll have a heart attack." And we get the boiler repaired. And I come in next day and say, "Okay, you've got hot water." They say, "Well, actually, we preferred the champagne. Can you turn the hot water off again?"
I'm sure that there are, you know, probably thousands of those anecdotes and stories that you've gathered over the years. And, you know, I'd like to thank you for sharing all your memories and for your time today, John. It's been really interesting and very entertaining talking to you. I'll put a link to a YSE in the show notes, listener, if you're looking for a holiday in Val d'Isère. But otherwise, I'd like to wish you all the best for the rest of the summer, whether it's in Val d'Isère or in Corsica, and all the best for your next winter, which will be your 49th, is that right?
Oh, this one was my 49th. It'll be my 50th, which I should celebrate, but I'm not going to. Getting old doesn't have many upsides, to be honest, Ian.
That's still a very impressive figure to have achieved. So thanks very much, John, and all the best for the winter.
Thank you, Ian, and goodbye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my interview with John Yates-Smith as much as I enjoyed chatting with him. He really is a fascinating guy. There aren't many people out there who have done 50 ski seasons. Now, I enjoy all feedback about the show. I'm always interested to hear what you think. So please do contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email theskipodcast@gmail.com. A few people have got back to me since the last episode. Dave Mills said, "Great podcast, adds to the excitement of another ski season." Adam Fisher said, "Good work with the podcast. I really enjoyed the Japan and Joanna Yellow Leaf Bound episodes." And Mike Greenland very kindly bought me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/theskipodcast and said, "Always entertaining. There are now 241 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and I had a look earlier today. 173 of those were listened to in the last week. You can do that too. There's so much to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest. And if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. Follow us. Just look for that button and press it now. Give us a review or leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And book your ski hire with Intersport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or take the link in the show notes. Now you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. But for now, I'd like to thank John for joining me. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.